Welcome to the Mind Gal Podcast, the show where we break down anxiety one show at a time and give strategies to release your negative thought patterns so that you can live your most fulfilled life. Get ready to challenge your narratives and gain the tools you need to overcome obstacles with your host, Monica Pitek Fugetti, a national certified licensed mental health counselor with over 15 years of experience helping people achieve their goals.
This episode of the Mind Gal podcast is an interview that I had with Lisa Lark, who suffers with anxiety, and she's going to explain to us how she has dealt with it, when it started, and some things that she has put into place that have helped her to manage her own anxiety, and hopefully it'll help you as well. So the interview starts off with me asking her about this pretzel. So you will hear Lisa go right into detail about the story of the pretzel.
I was in, I want to say seventh grade, so this would have been 1988, which was a banner year for my anxiety and also my haircuts. I started having panic attacks and anxiety attacks probably around 1986, so I was a pretty solid 2 years in. By this point, which made junior high even more fun than it would have been ordinarily. It was a constant struggle. Most days I didn't want to get up and go to school. Most days was a lot of a tug of war between my mom and I, sometimes metaphorical, sometimes literal. I remember getting up as early as I possibly could, getting fully dressed and then staying in bed till the last possible moment. I don't know if I thought maybe she'd forget I was there and just kind of just take my brother to school, but I was in the seventh grade. There's a food fight in the cafeteria. I wanted to be liked. I think a lot of us have this sort of peer pressure component to us. And so I chucked a pretzel across the cafeteria, just flung it. And then for the next 3 or 4 days was just crippled with anxiety and panic and fear. Found my journal from that time in my life. And I spent a solid 3 or 4 days analyzing every possible thing that had happened to understand what was causing the anxiety. There was nothing necessarily that caused it. I had it literally all the time. But I came across a great entry that literally said, I bet it was that pretzel. So I was able to make the pretzel my scapegoat for a solid week's worth of anxiety. And when I told Monica that story, it became her official code word for anxiety now. And I'm pretty sure I've committed to writing a children's book.
Called the pretzel. Pretzels, they're evil little pieces of dough.
Well, they make you thirsty.
They make you thirsty.
That was Seinfeld, I believe, who said.
You've had anxiety for as long as you can remember.
Yes, I date it to 1986 because that's when I started really noticing it inhibiting my life. Good side, bad side. I don't have a ton of memories from that time in my life. I'm assuming there's a little bit of blocking it out because they weren't necessarily pleasant memories. But yeah, it started middle school or elementary school, the end of elementary school. But I was always a nervous, twitchy little thing. I was always hyperactive. I was always, my mother likes to say I didn't sleep probably until I graduated from high school. So I was always moving around. I was always hyperactive. I always had something going on. So I can't say for certain, but 1986 is where I dated to, generally speaking. So that would give me a solid 32 years of anxiety.
And the interesting thing about anxiety is that it can go so hidden, and you were kind of a professional of hiding it. I never knew you had anxiety. A lot of the times anxiety can present itself as anger or defiance or all sorts of other things. We don't really know what the root cause is. You're lucky that it seems like you had parents that were willing to really dig into it to figure out what it was. Because back in 1986, it really wasn't like a thing people talked about.
Oh, no, there was no child psychology.
No.
There was a social worker at school, at the elementary school that we went to, and I can still see her face. I remember going down to her office. Some of my earliest elementary school memories are in her office. Also the scary gym teacher, but I think that's a different episode. My earliest years were, there wasn't a child therapist. There wasn't a child psychiatrist. I just started displaying things, behaviors in classes, and that ended up taking me to the social worker. And my family doctor was all it was for at least the first 2 years. Mm-hmm. My parents were more than patient and more than supportive and wanted to figure out what was wrong with me. And, you know, thank goodness they believed that there wasn't anything that I could do that could stop it. And that was pretty much the scariest thing as a kid of that age. You know, you're looking at 10, 11, 12 years old, and there's these things happening to your body that you physically can't stop. You look around the room and everybody else appears normal. And normal is not a word that I was allowed to use growing up, because my mom in particular was very clear that everyone has a different normal. So to compare yourselves to others doesn't really make sense, because you don't know what's going on in their world. I just remember feeling different, mm-hmm. you know, looking around and seeing people who were going through the school day and who didn't appear to be on the verge of tears all the time, and who didn't seem like they wanted to run out of the classroom. They seemed to go to school and enjoy it and talk to their friends and go to recess and enjoy it and not be controlled by this umbrella of fear just kind of hanging over my head.
Right. Do you remember who first brought it to the attention of your parents?
No idea. You know, like I said, a lot of it is blocked out. I've had some therapists over the years say that it might be PTSD adjacent, mm-hmm. Where I've blacked out chunks of my time. Mm-hmm. You know, so I can't recall an exact thing. The earliest one I remember was in the instrumental music class, but that doesn't mean that that was the first one. It doesn't necessarily mean that the instrumental music teacher, in fact, I can't imagine in a million years he would have noticed enough to send somebody to the social worker.
He was horrible.
So, yeah. So I don't recall. My parents might, but again, that was 32 years of panic attacks ago. So it's never come up in conversation, I'll put it that way.
What triggers you, or what do you recall when you were in school? What was the trigger?
Trigger is an interesting word for me, mm-hmm. Because mine attacks, at least at the time, didn't seem to have a pattern. And I know that because I spent years trying to find one and trying to avoid situations where I had an anxiety attack, thinking if I avoid that situation, it won't happen again. And so basically, from my point of view, it happened when I left the house. So initially, it almost made me agoraphobic, where if I stay home with my safe space, with my safe people, which was parents and predominantly my mom, that it wasn't going to happen. And then, as you know, from, you know, what you do for a living, that's not how any of this works. Mm-hmm. And then pretty soon I was avoiding movie theaters. I was avoiding shopping malls. I didn't spend the night away from home until I was probably 16. And that's including my grandparents' house, who we saw every weekend. So it was just a matter of eliminating the places, not necessarily the things, but also the things that caused me anxiety. And I remember, at least until the early part of high school, that was a big part of my therapy, was just recording when it happened and where it happened and what I had eaten, what I had drank, how much I had slept, all these different things, with the expectation that I would find something that triggered it. And, you know, looking back, that's kind of insane. One, because I know it's a chemical an illness in my brain. But at the same time, what if something like showering was my trigger? Were they just going to tell me, okay, just stop showering?
Right.
You know, and so looking back, you know, like you said, child psychology in the 80s was not a crack profession, at least in the area where we mm-hmm. grew up. Some of my earliest prescriptions were literally cough medicine.
One
doctor would tell me that I was hyperactive and I was too much sugar. So then my parents would take me off sugar for 2 weeks and then it wouldn't change. And so then they go back and maybe she's hypoglycemic. So maybe she's got low blood sugar. So then it was like, all right, we'll eat whatever you want. There was a guy that suggested that I get a fish and put a fish tank at the edge of my bed. And that was supposed to like relax me and help me fall asleep, with the idea, I think, being it would shut me up. I'm not really sure, but that did not help.
I can't imagine why.
Well, because it's a fish. It's a lot to put on a, you know, 59-cent animal. Really?
Oh, the poor fish got anxiety.
Well, I can imagine, because I was, you know, he's watching me swim back and forth in my room, and I'm watching him swim back and forth, and we're both freaking the hell out. So it didn't.
That's so funny.
The fish didn't last very long, and I don't recall there being a second fish.
A lot of parents, especially of children who struggle with anxiety, have a hard time understanding. Like, everybody has stress and everybody gets anxious, and all of that is true. But I think that it's important to point out that anxiety is a prevalent situation that just doesn't really ever cease. Mm-hmm. And you're always at some level of anxiety, mm-hmm. with different situations making it worse than.
Yeah, I think the best way that it was ever defined to me, and what really helped me understand it as an adolescent, and I can't remember where this came up, because I've had 10 medications, probably a dozen different therapists and social workers over my life. And so somebody had this piece of advice, and it was to envision anxiety like a roller coaster. Everybody's on it. So everybody's got anxiety. Some people start where you get on the little car, and I don't know what it's called, because I've literally never been on a roller coaster, because that's one thing that I'm afraid of. But everybody, you wait in line, you get in the car, your anxiety, quote unquote, normal anxiety starts where you board the roller coaster. My anxiety on my worst days starts at the very, very peak of the hill. So where someone who starts at the beginning of the roller coaster has, you know, the click, 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 click as they move their way up the track, they have dozens, minutes, hours to catch themselves and why am I feeling anxious, talk themselves through it, or if they're, you know, a lucky SOB, just ignore it because it doesn't even resonate that they're having it. On my worst days, I start at the very, very top of the hill. And that means by the time that something happens that pushes my anxiety over the edge, I don't physically have time to stop it, even though I have 32 years worth of tools to stop it. And I've become more intuitive. I can catch it earlier down the track than I used to. On my good days, I start much, much, much closer to the starting point of the ride than I did when I was, you know, my worst years were probably 12, 13, 14, 15.
Right.
So I've learned how to manage it, and I've learned how to control it, and I've learned how to recognize that, yes, this is a physical feeling. Yes, you're scared. Yes, you're anxious. And then I can look around and say, you are in a safe space. No, you know, you can go for a walk. You can get some water. You can take some deep breaths. You can tuck into a bathroom or whatever. And so I'm much more able to handle it, but I still have days where I wake up at the top of the hill, and then it's on me to try and figure out, what do I do to get myself to go a little bit backwards to be at a more manageable level?
Okay.
So the anxiety for everyone is always there. Mm-hmm. You know, anxiety doesn't just come from an anxiety disorder. Everyone has anxieties. Everyone has fears. Everyone has things that kind of scare them a little bit. The difference with my illness and, you know, what I've worked so hard to understand is that this is just me.
Right.
And there's ways that I can manage it. You know, I do have to watch what I eat. I do have to watch what I sleep. I'm not going to have a good day if I get 4 hours of sleep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to have a good day if I eat, you know, drink 64 ounces of Mountain Dew. It's going to amp me up. Does it mean that if I have 64 ounces of Mountain Dew, I'm absolutely going to have an anxiety attack? No, but it certainly increases the likelihood.
And I've noticed about you as an adult, Lisa and I recently traveled to Chicago together, and there was a group of friends of ours. We were all meeting, and I noticed you have a handle on who you are. And you, there were times when we were going to go to a bar, we were going to go to a crowded place, and you knew enough about yourself to say, I don't think I can go here, mm-hmm. and I'm just going to go home and rest. I'll catch up with you guys later. You also said that it was at the height at 14, 15, and 16 years mm-hmm. old, which is high school. That's a really, really tough age. And there might be some parents listening and maybe even high school students listening that don't know what to do with their student mm-hmm. when they're not as self-aware as you are as a 40-some-year-old woman.
Well, I was not self-aware at all at 14, 15, and 16. In fact, I was able to take my anxiety, which was crippling at certain points. I mean, if you were, you know, let's flash back to 1991. And if you're going to tell 1991 Lisa that we're sitting here having this conversation, one, she's going to be pissed off that she's still having panic attacks. She's not going to be pleased with that at all. But two, if you're going to portray an adult Lisa as a functioning member of society who's able to have a conversation like this without my mom sitting next to me having driven me here, I most days would not have believed you, because I was absolutely firmly convinced I would not get out of high school, because there was no way I could envision myself functioning as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
So that means, you know, being well enough to complete high school, let alone go to college, let alone get a job, let alone be someone's spouse or drive somewhere or anything like that. It was just foreign. And, you know, I think one thing that's important to point out is I'm not talking about a panic attack a week. I'm talking 7, 8, 9 a day
mm-hmm.
At, you know, my worst phases. I'm talking about not being able to shower, not being able to have my mother leave the room, you know, and at 14, 15 years old, I might have understood that everyone had their own set of challenges, but I certainly didn't know anyone that needed to fall asleep with their mom in the bed, because the alternative was that I was literally going to die. And so for me, yeah, I have self-awareness now, but at the time the first thing I would say is that don't assume your child understands at all what's happening to them. Having been in the classroom, I think one of the things that I always tried to remember when I was teaching was putting myself back in that position, is that we look at these kids as adults, and we assume that they understand what's happening in their minds and what's happening in their bodies. And a lot of times they just don't have any idea. Mm-hmm. They might be, like you said, they might act out, they might have anger, they might have resentment, they might have, you know, they might be the class clown, they might just be overly loud, they might just be defensive, they might just be stone silent. And, you know, I think for me, one of the things that I tried to focus on was just talk to them more about what they were feeling, you know, and even go down to the basic symptoms. You know, you look tired. How did you sleep last mm-hmm. night? Or, you know, you've been quiet today. And I know, you know, and having worked with some wonderful high school counselors in my teaching career, I know one of the things is changes in behavior. And that's such a huge one, because you get good at it. You know, like you said, we went all the way. If you figure we met in, let's say, 1980, mm-hmm. With the exception of maybe when you were in junior high and I was still in elementary, and then you were in high school and I was still in junior high, we were in school together for probably 10 years.
Yeah, easy.
And these,
we played tennis together.
Yeah, we had an awareness of it. You wouldn't have had any idea.
Nope.
Because I didn't want you to know.
Yeah.
And I had panic attacks during tennis matches.
Right. And I would have never guessed that ever.
But to me, in my mind, everybody sees it.
Right.
And there's no way you didn't know.
I once went to a workshop where it wasn't about anxiety, but it was about overcoming substance abuse and when you're clean now. And they explained it as, I want you to come into work or wherever your setting is the next day. I don't want you to do your makeup. I don't want you to do your hair. I want you to wear mismatched clothes. Mm-hmm. And I want you to go. And that is what it feels like for a recovering addict. I actually did this experiment and I felt totally exposed. Mm-hmm. I thought everybody was looking at me.
I legitimately believed a lot of the time that it's the most visible thing on the planet. Mm-hmm. You know, and my mom spent many, many hours trying to explain to me that, you know, in no uncertain terms, people don't give a crap because they're all so wrapped up in their own world, particularly as adults. Kids mm-hmm. might have been a little bit more noticeable because kids are always looking for that window they see more maybe, or they're, right. You know, you're right on top of each other. But certainly in high school, nobody cared. There might have been some people that noticed, mm-hmm. But more often than not, they noticed me leaving the classroom all the time. And they probably were jealous of me that I got to come and go as I pleased, mm-hmm. Not realizing that, you know, I was in the middle of this nightmare scenario of panic attacks constantly. And I was literally leaving the classroom so that the teacher could continue teaching.
Right.
That it was better for everyone if I just disappeared.
Yeah, you presented as such a normal, quote unquote,
absolutely.
Person, and you and got good grades.
I worked my
and...
butt off to present as a normal
right.
person.
But I think in some ways that's what puts you under the radar, which is mm-hmm. probably exactly what you want.
Oh yeah, I didn't need anybody to know. I mean, we didn't. My grandparents had no idea of the extent, and we went to church with them every single Sunday, and they didn't have any idea of what was going on. They didn't know I was in therapy. They didn't know I was, you know, getting medication. They didn't. And they found out when I was 16 from my dentist, because we all went to the same dentist, and I had had a panic attack while I was undergoing an EEG, not at the dentist, at a different doctor. Dentists don't do that.
They do not.
But I had had an EEG to see if I was having small seizures because the panic attacks were getting so bad. And I had a panic attack while I was getting this EEG. Until they could figure out whether or not it was a seizure, they took my driver's license away. And so my dentist had seen me, and somehow it came up that I didn't have a driver's license. And so the next time he saw my grandmother, he said, you know, how is Lisa doing with not being able to drive? And that's how my grandmother found out that I had. And by that point, I was 4 or 5 years in. You just didn't talk about it. I mean, this was the late 80s, the early 90s. I didn't know anybody who went to a therapist. I didn't know there were people that were mentally ill, and I did not want to be in that classification. To, you know, to a child in the 1980s, mental illness did not look like anxiety and panic attacks. Mental illness was straitjackets in the movies. I certainly wasn't going to tell anybody that didn't need to know. And so for a long time, it was parents and my little brother and, you know, the neighbor people that I would be able to feel comfortable with if my mom had to, God forbid, have a life that didn't include a 13-year-old daughter crying in her lap all the time.
Right.
Which strangely she did want. So
there you go. So what is a panic attack? A twofold question for you. What does a panic attack look like for you, and how do you know it's coming on?
It's interesting because they're so different in my mind now, but maybe they're the same. if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. Maybe they've always been like this. Certainly not as often. But for me, it's almost a weird chest tightening first. And it kind of goes into, I'm not comfortable in my own skin. So it almost feels like my heart's beating weird and my chest is tightening up. My breath becomes really, really shallow. I have a really fun sort of reverse swallow that I do, and I'll do it now. It's going to be awkward because it's not exactly right, but it's a lot of like,
oh yeah,
sort of a, that
like a tick almost.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. And then that usually if I catch it when the chest is tight, I can walk it off. I can have some cold water. Mints and crunchy foods are very helpful to me. Resets my brain. So if I have celery or carrots or apple or a lifesaver, or in high school, I was big on the little Brock's, the Starlight mints, the red and white ones, mm-hmm. which would also explain why I was at the dentist as often as I was. So I can catch it. So if we were, you know, one of my big absolutely fears is throwing up. It absolutely will knock me into a full-blown panic attack if I feel like I'm going to throw up. When I was younger, even the most mild piece of nausea would push me into a panic attack. And so now I can manage it before it gets to that point. Okay. But so, for example, on airplanes, there's a great opportunity for nausea because of turbulence. So when I fly, I always have some sort of mint, some sort of gum. I also have something to drink that's not water because I can't take my Xanax with water because it dissolves quickly and it leaves a nasty taste on my tongue, which then makes me nauseous, which is a circle of violence. So I always have something crunchy. I always fly with either celery or carrots or apples. And so, but once it gets to the ticks, as you call them, once it gets to my swallowing, if I don't catch it and am able to resolve it at that point, then I get into where I get into a self-harming window. Not necessarily consciously self-harm, although I have done that in the past, and that's another fun episode and Lisa time. But I pick. So I will scratch at my hands, or I'll scratch at my stomach, or I will pull at my belly button. And some sort of, a therapist once explained it to me as, I'm trying to find a physical reason for a emotional pain that I don't understand. So you would understand if I was crying because I was bleeding. Even if it was just a small thing, I could go, look, I'm crying and I'm scared because of my blood. Mm-hmm. But you're not going to understand it if I say, like, my brain feels like it's going to come out my head. And I assume this feeling will last forever and I'm probably going to die feeling like this. So it's a coping tool that I created in the very worst moments is to be able to explain to someone, why are you upset? Why are you scared? I'm bleeding.
Well, that makes perfect sense. I know that there's a lot of parents that are really at a loss when their child is struggling. I would imagine it took a lot of maybe trial and error in figuring out what helps you to calm down, like the crunchy stuff. What do you say to somebody who is saying, my child is suffering from this, but how do I figure out what helps him?
You listen, you watch. I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, my mom is an astounding human being. Never, ever gave up on me at any moment in time. There was no point where she felt like I would ever be limited by this. This was just something that happened. And I remember growing up, her pointing out that, you know, there were people in our class that were diabetic. You know, they would say to me, do you judge that person for this illness that they have? And I mean, that's groundbreaking stuff for 1986, 1987. Mm-hmm. You know, at no point did she look at me and say, there's something wrong with you or you're weird. And I'm sure there were, I don't even have to say it, I'm sure. There were times that we as a family were very frustrated and were very overwhelmed because this was brand new territory. This wasn't something that you could go to the neighbor and say, you know, who's Bobby's therapist? Nobody else had a therapist. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, looking back on our neighborhood, some of us probably should have.
Yeah.
So it was just a lot of time. It's a lot of, she watched me and she understood that there might not have been patterns that caused it. But once it started, there was step one through step two through step three and then up to step 10. And so she would become more adept at, you know, my whole family did. My best friends did. You know, everyone who spent time with me has seen me have a panic attack. Like if you were, we were friends in high school, but we were not running in the same circles. And the people that I spent the vast majority of my time with knew what it looked like. It takes a village. It was a wide network of people that would call me on the carpet and just be like, you seem X, like you seem jumpy. Do you want to go for a walk? So I left movies in the middle and I had friends that left with me and I left the mall in the middle. But one of the amazing things that my mom did that really helped me get through it is that she understood that if I stopped doing things because of it, the anxiety would eventually win. So what she did that was a genius move. And of course, not everything's going to work for everyone, but I always had to try. If I didn't feel like going to school, even if I was hysterical, we're going to go to school. You're going to try it for an hour. You call me if it's still bad, and then we'll figure out the next step. And so then it would become, okay, now I'm in the building. I can do 1 hour. I could do 2 hour, maybe third hour or at lunch. I start to get anxious again. I go to the counseling office. I go to the main office. I go to the nurse. I call mom. We talk through it. Sometimes I was allowed to come home, but then as time went on, she could tell the difference between me just needing to talk to her and me in the middle of something that was a bad situation, right, where I couldn't control it on my own, or I couldn't control it on the phone. So when we did that at malls, we did that at concerts, we did that at movie theaters. I mean, growing up, we were always leaving things early simply because we're going to try. I'm going to be on the tennis team. And if that means I have to fake an injury in the middle of the season so that I don't play anymore, we're at least going to try.
And I think that's a really key point that you bring up, that you have to try. Mm-hmm. Because if you give into it, then you're giving it power.
It wins. It wins. And I think that she knew on some level, through what she had experienced in her own life and what she had seen in her childhood, that, that it was surmountable and that it wasn't anything that as a family we couldn't learn to handle. Like I said, if you had told me at 15 I'd still be having anxiety attacks, I would have been livid, because it's not supposed to happen. I had a doctor tell me flat out, you will grow out of it. And so I'm still waiting to grow out of it. But I also understand that it's not a weakness. It's not, this is just the disease that I have. I would say I go maybe 2-3 panic attacks a year, maybe. And that's like hardcore stuff that is absolutely out of my control. I get some night ones now that are like night terrors, which are fine by me, but not so great for my wife. But for the most part, I have anxiety, but I know how to deal with it. I know what that feeling is. I know what I need to do to work myself through it. I know what I need to think about while it's happening and then after it's happening. And it's not something that controls me. And that's a testament to how my family and I fought it in the 80s and the 90s, was that it's a thing that happens, but it's not going to define us and it's not going to control us.
I think that there is such a stigma about non-visible illnesses. And then I suffered from breast cancer and I went through chemotherapy and I lost my hair. And to some extent, I feel quote unquote lucky that I lost my hair, because it was visible to people. And so people could understand, oh, she's sick, there's something wrong. Mm-hmm. And you give me leniencies because of that. But when you're walking around, I could have had cancer and not lost my hair and mm-hmm. been just as sick. And people don't know that. And the same thing is with anxiety, because you learn to be a fabulous actor.
Oh, for sure. And I think that you spend half your time wishing that no one sees it, because you don't want to talk about it. You don't want to acknowledge it. You don't want to give it power. But then at the same time, you spend time wishing there was someone that you could explain to, because it's not a feeling that most people can understand. So you want to be able to say to someone, like, doesn't it suck when, to use your illness, there's a network of people that you could go to. There's a support group that you could say, doesn't it suck when chemo saps your energy, or doesn't it suck when you lose your hair? Doesn't it, whatever. And that's really kind of what I longed for as a child, was someone who could commiserate, someone who I could talk to and say, like, this just sucks and I'm sick of it and I hate it. And then not have it be a thing to not talk about it for 2 more weeks.
Right.
But to be able to just be like, this is what I'm feeling now. And, at the time we tried a lot of different things. I had a lot of different diagnoses, and I went to an agoraphobic support group at one point. And I remember thinking, on one hand, like, this is fantastic because there's a name for what I have. And then when people started talking, I remember thinking, like, these people are crazy and I'm not these people. And so then even became like, I had a brief window of time where I felt understood and accepted. And I did. I think I went to 2 or 3 meetings of that group. But then these were people who literally never left the house except to come to these meetings. And it took days for them to prepare themselves to come to these meetings. And looking back, the concept of having an agoraphobic support group meeting in a public spot is kind of hilarious that I've never really landed on it until this moment. And so then I remember having this brief understanding of, at least they get part of me. at least they understand what it's like to feel overwhelmed and to feel like, if I leave this house, the panic attack is going to start. And the thing that I think is most maybe misunderstood is that everybody gets nervous and everybody gets scared. But most people have the mindset or what have you to know that it's going to stop. And when you're in that moment, when you're in the midst of a panic attack, you don't see that it stops. Yes, I've had thousands of panic attacks in my life, but when I'm in the middle of a panic attack, this will be the one that sticks. And then you're envisioning what the next week, the next month, the next years of your life are going to be like with that feeling never, ever going away. And that's where it brings in that sort of abject overwhelming and that abject sense of dread and loss of control, is because this is the one that's not going to stop.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it stopped 1,000 times. And I know in my rational mind and my intelligent mind that they're all going to stop, that I'm not going to be the medical marvel that has a 78-day panic attack. But in that moment, I don't believe that crap for a second. This is the one that's going to break me. This is the one that's going to, this is it. This is the one.
Right.
And, you know, and then of course you get into these feelings of, you know, I'm going to die. And then you're in this wormhole of I die. And then these people are left behind. And then what if this, and what if this, and what if that? And pretty soon you're now even deeper in the panic attack, because now you've added all sorts of other fears into that moment. And then it builds off of that. And so you go from the, you know, the anxiety piece to the fear piece, and then it goes into the shame piece. And then you're in this shame spiral of like, if you've done this 1,000 times, why can't you fix this? What's wrong with you? And then pretty soon 10 minutes have gone by and you've, you know, clawed the skin off of your own hand. And then you start the cycle again, because now it's, holy crap, I did it again. Mm-hmm. And then.
Anxiety is a tricky little beast. You can overcome the paralysis that anxiety brings, but anxiety is a lifelong illness.
Well, I think that's, it's interesting because it's not a past tense. It's not overcome. It's not, I have overcome. It's, you know, it's overcoming. I'm still in the process of overcoming. I mean, mm-hmm. there's still things that I carry with me all the time that I have to overcome, you know, maybe not daily, but certainly a couple times a week where what am I still doing here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've done amazing things in my life. And if you had gone back to 13, 14, 15-year-old me, saying that I taught for 9 years would have been insane. I did not feel safe in the walls of that school. And so to have the concept that I came back and I taught in that same building, because I taught where Monica and I attended, I couldn't have even laughed you out of the building, because it wouldn't have been even something you would have suggested. But there's still moments where I have conversations where I'm good at what I do, and people seek advice from me and they ask me for guidance, and I'll catch myself in the middle of answering thinking to myself, like, this is insane. I have no business doing this. I'm this scared kid. I'm 14, I'm 15. And I think a lot of times for all of us, whether you have anxiety disorder or not, you are who you were at your weakest point. So for some, it's a scared little kid. And for me, I was, you know, 13, 14, 15. That colors my whole perception of myself.
I think that's a really important distinction that you make, that you are who you were at your weakest point.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that kind of brings some clarity to the situation, because in our head, we're like, well, I'm a 40 some year old successful woman. I shouldn't mm-hmm. be curled up in a corner right now, but maybe at your weakest point you were, and that's who you go back to.
Yeah. And I mean, in my moments of anxiety, even if it doesn't get to a panic attack, but if I have a high feelings day, I do get that a lot. Like, I shouldn't still be doing this. Why am I still doing this? I have everything that I could have ever dreamed that I would want. I'm in, you know, a beautiful marriage. I have a wonderful family. You know, everyone is healthy, knock on wood. Everyone is happy. You know, my disease hasn't crippled me, but there's moments where I still go back to, like, it's going to end. Like, this is all going to come crumbling down. And that's why I think the panic attacks, I don't want to say they get scarier as I older, because as I get older, that's not necessarily true, but that's that in that mid-cycle fear is now I have something to lose. Back then I was just like, what is 14? Who cares if I never go back to school? Like, middle school sucks.
Right.
Like, I don't want to go back in that building with those people. It's horrible.
It's
13 and 14 year old girls are some of the scariest people on the planet. I don't want to go back there.
Overcoming middle school will be an episode.
Yeah. I've got nothing to lose. Overcoming my haircut.
right in the 80s.
Yes.
That's scary for everybody.
But, and so for me, I think now a lot of it comes to, one, I can't believe it's still happening. And two, is this going to be the one that breaks it? Is this the one that's going to, you know, make me lose my job?
Yeah.
Is this the one that I'm going to hurt myself to the point where I can't stop? Is this going to be the one where everyone realizes I'm a giant fraud? And that will lead us into the overcoming imposter syndrome episode.
But, right. We have so many overcoming
episodes. But no, I think a lot of it is that it's an ongoing thing. Mm-hmm. And I've come to terms with it. I mean, this is part of who I am. I'm not ashamed of it. I don't have any problem speaking of it. I don't have any problems sharing it with anyone who asks. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of the things that made me a good teacher and that's made me an advocate is because I want to do everything that I can to prevent another 13, 14, 15-year-old from feeling like I felt.
Right.
And one of the things that was most game-changing for me outside of my family was having an assistant principal at our high school that acknowledged her struggles, her similar struggles with me, and let me in a little bit to know that there was an adult that understood and that had similar feelings and that was functioning as an adult. When I went into teaching, that's one of the things that I tried to remember was that I was very open with my kids, not even in a one-on-one, in a group setting. I would say, you know, guys, I woke up a little anxious this morning. So if I have to take a walk and get some water, I expect you won't burn the place down while I'm gone. You know, and so for me, being open about my illness, being open about my struggles makes it more socially acceptable for someone else to ask for help.
I think that's really important to talk about it, to put it out there, to make it not as taboo as we used to think that it was, because people who suffer with anxiety disorders, and it could run the gamut from severe to mild, but you're still suffering from it. And I know that a lot of times people are like, well, I just have a mild anxiety issue. And so I don't want to talk about it because it doesn't mean anything with your severe anxiety issue, but that's not true.
Well, and it also, it meant enough for you to bring it up. I guess to me, the delineator between what I have and what quote unquote most people have is the control that it places over your life and the impact that it has on your life. Mine doesn't control me, but it still impacts me. There's still decisions that I make to avoid the possibility of it happening. I had knee surgery a couple of years ago. You know, I have a high pain tolerance because when you've had thousands of panic attacks, you learn to grit your teeth and bear it. But you got to take antibiotics after the surgery because you've just, your body was just open to the world. You know, the doctor gave me antibiotic pills, and with a crippling fear of vomiting, I do not do well with large pills. So it became, you know, the first day my wife crushed them up in applesauce. It's what my mom used to do when we were little. Neither my brother nor I can really tolerate applesauce anymore because it tastes like it tastes like medicine. So she put it in the applesauce, and then I was able to force that down, but it was terrible. It took me like 10 minutes to take this one, to eat this applesauce. It was horrible. So the next day she tried to crumble it up or mash it up and she put it in pop, thinking that the flavor of the Coke would mask the flavor of the pill. It did not. Force down. And then, you know, but at that point, you know, there's only a couple that they give you. So I have to take what's in the Coke because we don't have any more. You know, here I was at 41 years old, arguing with my spouse about why I needed to do this. And at that point in my head, it's like, okay, I'm going to take the risk to get a like massive staph infection to avoid taking one pill because I'm afraid it's going to make me throw up. Mm-hmm. And so it's impact. It's not controlling my life. I eventually figured it out. The next time I had surgery, we got a liquid, which was great because they make grown-up antibiotics. And most people don't even look at you if you're like, you're weird when you ask for antibiotic liquid and they say you're going to have to do like a cup each time. I don't care.
Totally fine.
I'll drink a cup. Doesn't matter. But still impacting my life. And I think that as parents and as teachers and as coaches and, you know, family members, that's what you look for. You look for, is it just happening? Is it impacting? And then what's the significance of the impact? And then is it starting to control? You know, is your child, is your student, are they avoiding something? Particularly if it's something that they didn't avoid previously.
I think that those are all really, really good points that you make. And I think that hopefully it helps some people to feel like they can relate to what they're going through and they're not alone. Because I do think it's important to know that if you're going through an anxiety disorder or if you're just finding yourself having anxiety and panic attacks occasionally, like you're not normal. If that makes sense.
I mean, this is something that everyone has.
It's something that everybody has.
And if you look at, I mean, even a quick Google search, which thank God WebMD was not around.
Oh my gosh. I would have all the ailments.
I would have 9 brain aneurysms all the time. But even a quick Google, I mean, and look at the number of people who are diagnosed each year. Look at the number of people that, you know, celebrities talk about it now. I mean, I would have killed to know that there was some famous person that would have said, like, this is what I deal with and look what I can do. Now you have professional athletes, you have movie stars, you have politicians and all these different people that do all these amazing things in the world. They're just like me. That matters. You know, the visibility matters and the conversations about it matters. And so being able to share even a small piece of this, if it makes someone look at me and go, well, if she can do it, then maybe I can too. And that is powerful.
And you, Lisa, is a very successful woman and leads a very productive life. And I think that's an important distinction to make, because you do not need to have the anxiety disorder does not have to own you.
If you would like to learn more about Lisa, please head on over to the show notes. Go to mindgal.com and look up the MindGal podcast.
Thanks for tuning into this episode of the MindGal podcast. Go over to mindgal.com now to sign up for your free 30-day anxiety challenge and have access to proven resources to help you manage anxiety. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast so that you don't miss any future episodes. And please take a moment to give us a 5-star rating and write a review in the App Store. Thanks for listening.